Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is songwriter, musician, director, writer, Viv Albertine. And we're talking about her latest book, To Throw Away Unopened. Viv, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you.
This book was amazingly powerful, and for me, it was unexpected. I didn't want to read any reviews. I didn't want to read anything about it, and I just sort of sank into it. And it was a genuinely emotional roller coaster ride. It's about your family, about your mother's death, and about you coming out at the other end. Talk to me about putting this. I thought your first book was really exposing a lot of yourself to the public. This yeah. really puts it all out there.
I know.
Did you have any trepidations about that?
Sort of. But I mean, the first book, I was much more scared because I hadn't done it before. And honestly, a perverse part of me thought, if I haven't put everyone off me with my first book, I'm going to have a darn good try with my second book. something about me, I can't help it. I'm a contrarian, you know, and I just thought, I just want to see how far I can push it. Will they hate me now after this one that I've exposed, you know, that I can be violent, that I'm angry all the time, that I have bad thoughts? You know, it was just interesting in a way.
It is. Because, it is. It's yeah. very... It's honest. I don't want to say brutally honest because I don't think it was that. But it was deeply honest. I mean, I became fascinated by your hairy legs.
So I'm hoping I'm setting a trend there.
let's talk about your family. Starting with your father and your mother. Your father's name was Lucien. And what was your mother's name?
Kathleen.
Now, they were divorced fairly early on in your life. And you grew up with your mother. This book also centers on the passing of your mother, and it stretches that out throughout the entire book by breaking up the death of your mother. And that effect, that literary effect, was startling because seconds seemed like hours reading about what was going on in your mother's deathbed.
I think when you have sort of you know, very extreme things happen to you, time does absolutely go out the window and stretch. It was like that. I mean, I didn't want to use that device just as a sort of, you know, sort of a self-conscious literary device.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I wanted to split, you know, two ways that came about. One is that I absolutely couldn't write and couldn't think of that night that my mother passed away for more than a few seconds at a time. And I think that's what humans do when they have a trauma. I think you do only let little bits of it back into your mind, like flashes, don't you, when you think of any sort of trauma. And I thought, well, I can't write about it all in one chapter. I can't think about it more than a few seconds at a time, so I'm going to have to use that positively in the book, you know, and make it part of the structure. And I hope that it doesn't seem self-conscious because
it
was the only way I could do it.
It really doesn't. But it, for the reader, it's startling. And to the point where I was like telling people about it as I was going along, you know, I'm going, oh, my God. Like, what do you remember about your father? This is before you uncovered the papers. Like, what did you remember before all this happened about your father? What was he like?
Well, this. You know, after my mother and father separated, I didn't see my father again for about 15 years. So firstly, I just remembered him as this big sort of rough, gruff-voiced sort of ogre with a violent sort of tendency. And then when I found his diary,
oh my God.
I felt really sad for him. I thought, you know, he was a simple man out of context, you know, because he's actually French Corsican, and there he was in England trying to be English, trying to learn English. Absolutely not accepted, you know, because foreigners after the war were still thought of in very suspicious ways. And he was also sort of not clever enough to sort of keep up with my mother. And there was my mother, resentful that she was cleverer than him, but couldn't get a job because women after the war couldn't get work, had to stay at home. You know, and it was just so interesting to realize how much we were all sort of victims of the times we were born in, rather than just very bad people.
Talk about how you found this diary of his. And it's an interesting experience being a reader, reading the sections of the diary as the book proceeds, because I started finding myself going like, well, he wasn't that bad. I felt sorry for him.
I felt sorry for him.
Up to a point. And we'll talk about that.
Sorry for all men, you know, whilst I read my diary.
I can't believe what... But so how did you get hold of this diary?
Well, basically, found both my parents' diaries after they died, and I think that happens to a lot of people. You find paperwork or little secrets come out, and they were a very, very secretive generation. It's not like now where you're allowed to talk about your failings or, you know, your affairs or whatever. It was a very secretive generation, and I found his diaries, didn't read them, stuffed them in a cupboard, and then when Mum died, I found her diaries. And the interesting thing was they were both diaries of the exact same 2 years, 1965 to 1967, Jesus. Day by day. And they were, you know, just interesting historical documents in a way, you know, that they had both documented the same 2 years for the purposes of divorce. So you had to do that back then. And what very different people they showed themselves to be. My father was all very, went downstairs, made a sandwich, Kathleen not talking to me, went to the bank, came back, you know, drew out £25, came back. I mean, it was so simple and straightforward, and sort of, he's on the autistic spectrum, which we didn't know those words
back
then.
That's right.
And my mother's was setting up the whole of their relationship, how they met, you know, just at the last year of the war and got together, and, you know, setting an awning context, you know, it was just two very different people. And then I had my own memories of that time as well.
It was weird because reading, first the reader reads the excerpts from your father's, Lucien's diary.
Don't give too much away.
Oh my God. Yeah. And people are going to have to read this, but then, you know, you're starting to feel like he's just in this loveless marriage and his wife is turning the kids against him. And then you read your mother's diary, and all of a sudden it becomes like Rashomon. You know, it's like it's like holy crap.
Yeah.
It's two people trapped in a relationship who really don't belong together. And and now that's, and we'll talk more about the discovery of her mother's diary in a minute. There's your sister. Pascal, is that how you pronounce your name?
Pascal, yeah.
No, she's got a weird history with your mother and you. Like, she moved away very early on.
Yeah. I mean, I you know, wonder, you find out so much. It was like a detective story writing the book. And I actually,
I read
a lot of sort of domestic sort of thrillers set in the home whilst I was reading. And I, you know, like a domestic noir, made it a page turner kind of thing. So in a way, you know, you could ask how truthful is it in many ways, because I had such a hand in constructing the shape of it and everything. But I forgot what the question was about.
Oh, your relationship with your sister. Like, your sister is, first of all, is she older or younger than you?
I was younger, but it was a very normal relationship up to a point where my mother and father started to fall apart. But you can't ever look at what they did to each other and to us without placing them in the context of the 1960s and the divorce laws and the patriarchy that was so strong at the time. You know, and that it was only sort of 15 years after the war. You know, that's what I realized as I plowed through the book looking for the truth of why I was an angry person, you know, why my sister and I had the relationship we had. I don't want to give too much away. The detective story unveiled, you know, how much we are a product of our time. It made me forgive everyone involved, because I think once you understand anyone, you know, whether they are a criminal or just someone in your family, once you understand the generations that went into making that person, the times they were born in, the genes they had, et cetera, et cetera, you can understand. And once you understand, you don't feel hate anymore.
Well, you had to go through a lot to get to that point.
Yeah, 3 years.
And your sister, early on, she moves away to Canada, and you basically don't hear from her a lot for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I think that may be fairly normal that people move away. But the thing is, the strange thing is, you know, she was young. She wanted to, you know, explore other countries, et cetera. But what was weird was how resentful I felt for doing that and for leaving my mother. Because I very much felt that my mother had sacrificed everything in her life. You know, she had no money. She had no clothes. Every penny she had went on us. So we looked, you know, presentable. She gave up, you know, having an interesting life to sort of bring us up. We were poverty stricken, and I felt furious with my sister, and it never went away, that fury for leaving Mum after and so me being supposedly the rebel, I couldn't leave. I mean,
now there's also your daughter, and this whole family dynamic. You know, you talk about not wanting to give anything away. I want to say, for the benefit of the audience, don't look at this as like a detective story, but look at it as an emotional event that you live through. because that's what's going on in this book. It's a powerful book, so we can talk about whatever. I don't think giving away anything is going to. But you've got your daughter there, and you're obviously concerned about your daughter and how she's going to view things, as everybody does, as everybody does. And then there's all these other peripheral characters. You find out your mother had a child by a previous marriage.
Yeah. I think you're giving away a bit too much, Mark, going through the whole story.
Oh, okay.
I'd much rather you talk about the structure of it or what I was trying to find out. But you're spoiling it for the reader, in my opinion, because you're giving away things.
Okay, I won't.
I've spent years setting up.
Okay. I won't do that. I won't do that. Okay. We won't talk about it. But there is finally a big confrontation with your mother and your sister. And that's all I'll say is one of the great moments of stuff that I've ever read in a book.
A murder scene in a murder mystery, really.
Oh, my God. Now, the title of the book comes from where?
Yeah, so the title of the book comes from, again, I would rather not give it away, but it was something to do with my mother, because, again, that's placed three-quarters through the book where you discover that where that comes from. So, you know, I just don't want to sort of unveil everything. It took me over a year just to structure the book so that you came across things like a detective, piecing things together, because I do think families are places where certain sort of crimes are committed, you know, and sometimes they're psychological crimes, but they still have a devastating effect. And that's how I've, structured the book. And
sure.
I don't want to give away all those little
I respect
clues
that, then. Okay, I respect. Let's talk about getting old, because one of the other things that happens in this book is you're very honest about what it's like to date and get old. And I'll tell you, as a person that's slightly older than you, I found that both depressing and real and funny.
I wanted to make it funny, really, because it is hilarious attempting to date, you know, as you get older. And people have so many more problems. They've compounded, you know, with age, and people are more set in their ways. And, you know, there I was still looking for this romantic love that I was thinking about when I was 15. And I've got real now. It's really, you know, I've really come to terms with the fact that I it's not fair on anyone to be looking for that sort of idealized romantic love, and especially not if you get older. And that's a complete liberation to me, actually, to have come to that realization.
There's a section of the book where you talk about what it takes for you to get presentable to go on a date.
Yeah.
I think it's this Eric.
Eric, yeah.
And I mean, I'm not kidding you. It goes through an entire page of everything that you need to do.
As a woman.
As a woman. And the guys don't do that, first of all.
No.
You're absolutely right. And and I think that was the first time I really confronted that in detail. I mean, I had a sense of that, but I didn't have that must piss you off.
Thing is, it does, and it makes me so relieved I'm not doing it anymore. But I'm, you know, and as I ended that chapter, I said, if men had to do all this to get ready for a date, they would not date. And I'm with them now. I'm not going to date either, if that's what it takes to look like men want you to look like. And on top of that, straight men I'm talking about here, on top of that, you know, it costs so much money, and we try and hide it. So, you know, I arrived, you know, plucked and shaved and dyed and God knows what. And he had no idea. He just thought, that's how women look. She looks normal. She's got out of bed, made herself breakfast and packed her bag, and here she is. And he had a toothbrush poked into his top pocket. That's what he'd done.
And it wasn't really worth it in the end.
And it certainly wasn't worth it in the end, except as a lesson and a good chapter in a book.
Although, you know, and by the way, thank God for sections like this in this book, because it's like sort of a little bit a calming down from, oh my God.
You know, a funny thing, though, my male editor told me to take out the section where, you know, during the night I'm trying not to pass wind.
No!
on my date with Eric, because he thought it spoiled my cool vid from the Slits image.
No, that you mean Barbara Fartland or whatever the chapter is called.
Barbara Fartland.
But you know, but again, what I appreciated about that is the reality of it. It's not it's not a comedy bit. It's a thing that anybody who's older, who's going out on a date, thinks about. Trust me, everybody thinks about, and hopefully, I do. And you know, that's just the realities of that. Now, one of the things that happens in the very ends of the book is that you seem to have come through things and almost had an epiphany and a change of person. Is that safe to say?
What, myself changed?
Yeah. I mean, the whole, like, last 30 pages of the book, there's a totally different tone from the first part of the book. And it's like you're like walking around looking at flowers in a field, and it's interesting. And I found it really fascinating. It's like you had some kind of you really found like you came to terms with things, and then you're moving on.
No, it's not how I read it. I mean, I think all through the book, I'm talking about where I live and crossing London fields, which is, you know, got wildflower meadow and everything. And I did weave that sort of what I call sort of psychogeography through the book. Because it does ground, in the end, that's what grounds me, the material things around me, whether it be, you know, the bricks and mortar of where I live or the plants or whatever, because I find dealing with emotions almost impossible now and completely shy away, even almost from friendships as well as, you know, having lovers. But, yeah, I didn't so much have an epiphany as forgive, I think, at the end.
And then
I don't think it's a particularly happy ending.
You're the one giving away stuff now.
I know.
No, it's not that there's a happy ending or like a made-for-TV result, everything gets resolved.
Yes, exactly.
But I think you come out having realized some things about the rest of your life as you're older. One of them, and I want to talk about this, is about loneliness.
Yeah.
Talk to me about how you feel about loneliness.
Well, loneliness, I just feel it's one of the last taboos, and it's getting so, you know, one's so embarrassed to say I'm lonely, and people cringe and flinch if you ever say it. If someone asks, how are you, and you say, I've got a bit of a cold, or, you know, I've hurt my foot, or whatever, there's no problem. But if you say, fine, you know, I'm doing this, and I get a bit lonely at times, my daughter's left home, they flinch, oh no, you know, if you've said, I'm about to die. And to me, I think I want to expose loneliness for what it is and make it not such an unacceptable thing to say or feel or fess up to, you know, to confess. And I just wanted to expose it. I like exposing taboos, whether it's talking in reality about what your relationship with your siblings is like or what your mother's death was like and what being lonely is like. And a lot of female artists I know do live very solitary lives. And we mustn't mix up being solitary with being lonely, because being solitary is something that some of us embrace. And I do have lonely moments, but I had lonely moments when I was in my marriage. You know, I had lonely moments when I was in the Slits in a band touring. You know, and I think the more we speak about it, the less of a taboo it'll become, and the less of a failure young people will feel if they feel those things. Because meanwhile, they're seeing all their friends post pictures on Facebook, Instagram, or whatever. And there is this sort of cult of looking like your best all the time in public, you know, whether it's on the internet or whatever. And I just want to counteract that with saying loneliness is what we all feel, you know, no matter if you think someone's cool, being in a band, I'm lonely, you know, and I have lonely moments and I face them and I go to bed and I go up, wake up the next morning and it's better. So, you know, there's some guidelines.
Did you learn a lot from your mother about dealing with loneliness?
Yeah, my mother never felt lonely. Never. She was extraordinary.
But she had you.
She had me, and she was always extremely pleased when I went away, and she had the time for herself. But, you know, I have my daughter, but I do feel loneliness. My mother didn't. She, you know, and I often think she was alone from about the age of 48, apart from me. Not many friends, two friends maybe, if that. And there was never any, you know, feeling of loneliness. She enjoyed her own company. She was relieved to be on her own. And I think that comes from being in a different generation where she thought all her life she was going to be in a marriage, cooking for a man, cleaning up after a man, being second to a man, you know, and she never, never got over the absolute freedom she felt of living in her own flat, doing things at her own time. She loved it, reveled in it.
I love you talking about in this book about things that you dragged your mother to. First of all, your mother went to some of your concerts.
Yeah, my mum came to every single concert in London that I ever played. she's always on the guest list plus one. She'd drag some work colleague with her or something. I took her to a very hardcore lesbian and gay alternative film festival.
Yeah, now you just sort of glanced you just sort of glanced over that in the book
on Mother's Day.
So what did she think about that?
She was absolutely rigid in her seat. It was hardcore sex scenes using sex toys and strap-ons and
what they want. Viv! How old was she? How old was she at the time?
Like 60s, probably.
And so did she talk to you about it afterwards?
Yeah, we had a giggle about it afterwards. We could talk about anything, absolutely anything, you know, from sex to drugs to whatever. Yeah, we talked about everything. But yeah, we had a laugh about it afterwards. Frankly, it was a bit hardcore for me, to be honest. I took her to see Sparks in concert. Anything no one else would come and see me with, I would take her to.
First of all,
I miss that so much.
First of all, when I read that in the book, I'm a huge Sparks fan. And there are a few people that would bother to go see Sparks, and I'm so glad you went to see it and you dragged your mother to it.
I dragged my mother, yeah. In fact, I've got tickets to a play on Tuesday. I can't find anyone to come with me, and I just kept thinking, if only Mum was still around, you know.
Oh, my God.
She was my great companion.
She's really
an intelligent, fun person as well.
She really was. Now, how is your relationship with your daughter, Vida, reflecting your relationship with your mother?
It made me realize that we all look back to how we were parented as clues to how to parent, because we're not really taught much how to do it. And, you know, as I said, you know, she sort of taught me how to handle death. She taught me how to be a grandmother in the way that she was a grandmother to my daughter. You know, she was a fantastic grandmother. I shall be that sort of grandmother if I ever am one. In other ways, I think, oh, my God, she really was a bit too lax with us as well, you know, letting me hitchhike to Amsterdam when I didn't know what country it was in.
Oh, my God.
In some ways, she was completely lax, too lax, but she was absolutely determined that I was going to have the freedom that she never had. So she swung the other way. And I quote Gloria Steinem in the book, that wonderful line, I lived my mother's unlived life, and... Yeah, my mother schooled me to live a life of risk-taking, experimentation, freedom. And, you know, it was a risky thing to do with a girl in those days, and it was a very, very unusual thing to do, you know.
Yeah, I want to talk about, you use quotes at the beginning of every chapter, and I found them really precious and, like, important. Like, they were really about that chapter. It wasn't just you flexing your intellectuality to everybody, but they were really well chosen. I was surprised, Viv, but it was real. You're very intellectual.
I'm not really, but I do love sorting out and finding the right quote for a chapter, because I think sometimes if someone's encapsulated something in a line, it can go with you for the rest of your life. I mean, I have a few quotes that I think of, you know, in my darkest, deepest moments, like, I lived my mother's unlived life, or nothing good ever gets away. I think that was Steinbeck. They're a great comfort to me. So that was one level I used the quotes. But another level is that I wanted to credit all the women that I'd
read. That's right. That's right.
All the women I'd known. Because sometimes it's a very clever, intellectual woman who's written a book. And sometimes it's my mother or my aunt. And I wanted to give them all equal billing, in a way, or equal credit. Because a lot of female history is oral and has been passed down orally, you know. And I wanted to sort of acknowledge that and give my friend Tracy or my auntie the same billing and the same amount of paper on the page as I would, you know, Maya Angelou.
Finally, is it you just sort of are now comfortable with, you're probably never going to find another person to fall in love with, right? And you have an interesting quote in the book, if I can quote you. Finding another person to love is just finding another person to lose, because at your age, it's eventually one or both of you are just going to fall prey to decrepitude.
Yeah, die, let's say it, come on. and the thing is, the funny thing is, when I fell in love with my husband, who I had my daughter with, I suddenly became terribly frightened of his death, and I'd never really felt that before, except
That's
my
right.
mother. And it really sort of put it's my own problem, but it really put a sort of dampener on the relationship that I was utterly, I didn't realize that to love someone that much meant that you were going to be terrified of losing them. And I'd never had that before. And I honestly don't know if I'm strong enough to get that deep in with someone that I am so, I'll be scared of losing them. And of course I will lose them because of my age and their age, et cetera.
That's right.
Unless I get someone much younger than me. But yeah, I don't know. You know, never say never that I won't meet a partner or whatever, but the amount, as I said in the book, the amount of effort that goes in, the amount of, is not worth the returns. The investment's not worth the returns in terms of even on the day-to-day level for me, the hassle of it and the lack of good manners and just caringness of the men I've met is just not worth the headspace it takes up for me.
Yeah,
I've got work to do.
And I want to ask you about that. We've just got a couple of minutes left. You're now an established writer. Are you comfortable with that? That you're going to continue to write?
I'm very comfortable with that. I love the long form of book writing. I can't say love every day. I mean, I sit down every day to write a book. It takes a couple of years, 2 to 3 years. I can't say I love it. It's a battle and a puzzle, but it's very, very engaging. And it's just, you know, having written songs, I take that knowledge and that experience of songwriting with me, and it very much comes through in the book, I think.
It does.
In the paragraphs and the structures and et cetera. But, I'm happy at the moment, but I am changeable. I definitely want to write at least one more book. There's one in me. I know what it is. It's bubbling away. So.
Oh, okay.
And I hope it'll sort of surprise you again.
This was really surprising, and I know we didn't give away too much. The experience of reading this is something. My guest tonight has been songwriter, musician, director, writer, Viv Albertine, and we've been talking about her latest book. It's got a great title, To Throw Away Unopened. Viv, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.